Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I am here with Dr. Jan Timbrook, and she is important, and she's important to me, and I'll tell you why. So if you cast our collective minds back to 2008 or 9, I have my best friend for 35, 6 years is Native American, and he is from the tribe called the Ute tribe. And Eli, who Richard's actually met, came to visit my new town because I had just recently moved to Santa Barbara in 2008. And the Museum of Natural History was hosting a talk by Dr. Jan Timbrook and a tour of the new Chumash plant gardens. And I said, this is perfect. Eli's got to come down from San Diego, or come up from San Diego and see. Actually, no, by that time he was living in Oregon. He's got to fly from Oregon because we have to attend this lecture and tour. And we did, and it was fantastic. And we bought the book, The Chumash Ethnobotany, Plant Knowledge Amongst the Chumash People of Southern California, which I proudly have today. And we heard Dr. Timbrook speak. And I walked the garden with Eli, who grew up on a reservation in the Four Corners. And I said, you know, this is amazing to me that even something as simple as a cure for baldness was known, and how this was known and passed down. And he said, well, we've been here a long time. And I thought, yeah, I guess so. So today on the program, I have Dr. Timbrook here, and I just had to start the hour off by telling this story because, you know, that book's been on my shelf for a long time. I think about that day. I think about that garden, and it was one of the first introductions to my new town. And then we have right now at the Santa Barbara Natural History Museum, we have a wonderful exhibition, The Living Art of Chumash Basketry. It opened on the end of January, and we're going to celebrate that a little bit today. It's a new exhibit in a familiar space, by the way, and it demonstrates the creative variety of uses and designs in traditional basketry. And when I was talking to Eli about this fact, you know, the fact that these plants had medicinal properties for generations upon generations in the Chumash culture, what's really interesting to me is the baskets that are so technologically important. I think about, now if you can imagine this, you can weave so tightly that water will not really penetrate. You know, you can store water in some of these baskets because they're woven so tightly. You can cook in these baskets. On the same token, some of these baskets, all of these baskets really, that you're going to see at the museum are works of art. And, you know, they're more than just beautiful objects. They're functional. We have a different idea of beauty when you look at these baskets because they're function and they're beauty, and that is hand in hand. So they're functional because they're beautiful. They're beautiful because they're functional. It goes hand in hand. So Jan Timbrook has cared for and learned from special baskets and icons like this for more than 50 years. Amazing woman, and we have a great pleasure of talking with her today. She's curator emeritus of ethnography at our museum. She's an anthropologist and an ethnobiologist, and she studies the interaction of human societies with plants and animals. Her specialty is the indigenous Chumash people of the Santa Barbara region, their uses of plants in food, medicine, and basketry. She's a curator in the anthropology department in the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History for 45 years, one of the top experts in Chumash studies. She has degrees in anthropology and art from UC Santa Barbara. She's done many, many books, four books, including studies of traditional history and ritual in the Chumash plank canoe, and authored many scientific papers on topics ranging from herbal medicine to environmental management by the Chumash. And I already talked about her book, Chumash Ethnobotany, a landmark study based on three decades of research, first published in 2007. So, Jan, I must have gone to one of the first lectures that you gave. It's been reprinted four times, and it's released now in a second edition. She's nominally retired from the museum. However, whenever the museum needs her advice, she's kind enough to participate and gets called on. Past president of the international organization, the Society of Ethnobiology. For 25 years, she's worked with the California Indian Basket Weavers Association to produce exhibits of baskets by contemporary native weaver. And part of the exhibit that we're going to talk about includes centuries, actually, of basketry. Jan, thank you for being with us today and talking about the baskets. And I want to ask you, Jan, to talk about your favorite basket in the exhibit.
Wow, thank you for having me on your show. I think the most impressive basket in the exhibition and in the museum's collection is what we call a presentation basket. It was woven, we think, between about 1815 and 1822 at Mission San Buenaventura, by a woman named Juana Basilia Sitmelelene. And it's one of seven baskets in existence of this type, which has heraldic designs from Spanish colonial coins woven in. And then around the rim are actually words of dedication, saying, you know, basically this basket was made by Juana Basilia, desirous of contributing to the attentions from Governor Solá to his illustrious Field Marshal Don José de la Cruz. And those words were actually written in Spanish around the rim of this basket that was woven in while she was making it. And what it indicates is that the last Spanish governor of California, Solá, who served from 1815 to 1822, had this basket made as a special gift for one of his military officials. So it's extraordinary because Native people at that time were not taught to read and write. So somebody had written out this inscription and told her to figure out how to weave it into the basket, one stitch at a time, one row at a time. It's just an amazing, amazing basket. It has about 220 stitches per square inch. It's a natural treasure.
Wow. You know, you talk about the people, you're quoted in the Chumash Basketry, Art and Life. You're quoted as saying, people who make these baskets are scientists. They're botanists who are familiar with the plants. They're ecologists who know how to take care of them, where they can be found, how to promote the growth. They're mathematicians. Give me an example of how the basket weavers are mathematicians, Dr. Timbrook.
Well, they didn't draw out the designs ahead of time. You know, they just had a vision in their head of what the basket should look like and figured out how to make that happen by counting stitches and calculating how to expand the design as the basket grows larger while they're weaving it. So it's, and they're scientists because they spent so much time closely observing the environment and the properties of the plants and animals too around them, and how they could be cared for and modified and help with various human needs. So, you know, people sort of laugh about basket weaving. They sort of look at it as some simple-minded kind of thing, but that is absolutely contrary to the truth. Basket weaving is a really, really sophisticated form of knowledge and practice.
I understand that. Now, you say they don't draw out the designs. They had the designs in their heads?
Yes.
Give me an example.
Well, like, I mean, the designs from the Spanish colonial coins that are woven into this one particular basket, they're heraldic designs that have the coat of arms of Spain. And so they had that as a pattern to work from. But most of the Chumash baskets don't have pictorial designs. They have more geometric patterns. And because the basket grows larger as you're weaving it, you have to figure out how to calculate to keep the design going and not leave big gaps in the pattern. So you add elements so that you can maintain the pattern to look consistently throughout the whole size of the basket. So most weavers have told me that they, you know, they don't draw it out ahead of time. They just have it in their head what the basket is going to look like, and they make it happen. Although sometimes, admittedly, the basket has a mind of its own and decides to turn out a little bit different than what they had imagined.
So this is a sort of an analogy question. So I'm thinking of the on rugs, Native American rugs in particular. I'm thinking of the storm pattern. And I'm thinking of the geometric, almost like lightning bolts. Unless you are familiar with the symbology, you don't necessarily realize, that's the storm pattern. Are there similar sort of recurring patterns in the Chumash basket tradition?
There are sort of a set of standard design elements. They're not necessarily symbolic. They do have names, a lot of them, but it's just a convenient way of referring to what that pattern looks like. It doesn't necessarily mean that it symbolizes a particular thing, like, you know, lightning or, you know, there's a butterfly design, there's water strider design, but that's just a way of recording what it looks like. There's sort of usually radiating patterns out from the center, like lightning designs radiating out from the center. And it's different to execute that than it is in Navajo weaving, the storm pattern that you mentioned, because that's
right.
Straight, whereas the basket is curvilinear. So it's really a challenge to make these geometric patterns and make them come out even when you're working in a circular format like that.
So can I ask you the status of the basket weaver amongst the people? You know, I realize many of the basket weavers are female. And I'm wondering, are they held in high regard amongst the people? Are they artisans that become sort of revered, or are they kind of worker bees that are just making the baskets for utilitarian purposes, and it's just the same as maybe a cook or somebody? You know what I'm saying? Are they important? For example, we have the cult of the genius artist, you know, in the Western tradition. Talk to me about how the basket weaver was viewed.
Well, I think probably most women learned how to make baskets or knew how to make baskets, but not everybody is equally good at it, obviously. And so
right.
A weaver who is really skilled, who makes really well-made, sturdy, strong baskets that are beautiful would be held in high regard. And she could always sell or trade her baskets for other kinds of things, consumer goods, food supplies, tools, whatever. And so I think, yes, I think basket weavers were definitely respected and admired for their skill. Now, the presentation basket that I was talking about, I mean, those weavers, there are three known weavers who made baskets of that type. And they were commissioned by mission authorities to make these baskets for, you know, high officials. And so, obviously, even in Spanish times, their work was very, very highly regarded and respected. Now, in terms
right.
of, most basket weavers were women. In some cultures, at least, men made baskets for hunting and fishing kinds of purposes. And also in some cultures, men would make cradle baskets for their sisters' children. I don't know whether that's necessarily true among the Chumash, but there's really a great deal of kind of variability from one culture to another in terms of things like that.
I didn't know that. That's quite remarkable. So a male basket weaver would make a baby carrier for his sister and her children.
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing. We don't know if that was in the Chumash tradition, but we know that was in the tradition. It speaks to me a little bit about how the basket weaving was taught.
I would say that it's by observation rather than in traditional times, at least, that you know, little girls would probably learn at their mother's knee, maybe help prepare materials or work with the scraps of trimmings that that the mother had taken off when she was, you know, sizing the material to be the right width. So little girls would probably experiment with that and just learn by observation, not necessarily formal instruction. Nowadays, there is formal instruction, going on in Chumash basket weaving. There's a contemporary weaver, Samantha Sandoval, who actually since last fall has been teaching a traditional Chumash basket weaving class for Chumash people specifically. Nobody else is allowed to participate. That's the first time that's ever happened in my memory, certainly. So it's a huge achievement that a Chumash basket weaver herself is spreading this knowledge, and young people are learning, and it's going to be carried on into the future.
Well, that's beautiful. Another question for you. How do you care for such baskets? In other words, how does the museum, how do they curate these baskets? Where are they stored? How are they stored? What are the important things to remember because they're organic, for example?
Right. In the museum, we have a climate-controlled collection storeroom that maintains, ideally, an average temperature of 65 degrees and 50% relative humidity. So it's a very stable environment. And then the baskets are kept inside closed cabinets in that room. And so they're sealed around the edges. So it's a very, very stable environment. And I think that's the crucial thing. If you have baskets at home, you don't want to put them in a sunny window. You don't want to put them near like a heater or air conditioning vent, because that means rapid changes in temperature and humidity, which will cause the materials to swell and shrink, and you'll get cracking ultimately. So the key thing is to keep them in a really stable environment with as little fluctuation as possible. Ideally, you know, if it's a really good or really fragile basket, you'd keep it in a closed display case, like a vitrine. The single most important thing to remember is how you pick a basket up. Do not ever pick it up with one hand so that you're putting pressure on the rim. We see so many baskets that have really serious rim damage from being mishandled in that way. So always pick a basket up with two hands underneath. That's my recommendation.
Oh, that's amazing. I never knew that. I have a number of Navajo baskets, and yeah, this is really good advice. Nice to know. So I want to know also, because you study the native flora and fauna, what kind of materials are included? Can you name some of the plants that are involved in these baskets, Dr. Timbrook?
You want botanical names?
Yeah.
The main material, well, there's two kinds of Chumash baskets. There's twined and coiled. And twined is more like what we think of as weaving, which is done with two strands at the same time. But and that's usually, that can be willow or sourberry sumac or sometimes tule. But the really fancy, pretty Chumash baskets that everybody admires so much, those are mostly made with a particular kind of rush called Indian rush or basket rush. It's Juncus textilis. And it grows in kind of wetlands, not right in the water, but sort of where there's moisture in the soil. And it's a tall, narrow reed kind of plant. And so you harvest that usually in late summer when it's full grown, let it dry for about a month, and then put it in the sun if you can, so that it turns this really pretty golden color. And then you split that lengthwise into usually four pieces. You scrape out the inner cottony pith and size each strand so that it's suitable for weaving. So that's the main weaving strand. And then sourberry sumac is another one that has really white material, and that's a woody plant that looks a lot like poison oak. So you need to be really careful that you know what you're getting when you're collecting that. So those are the two main materials. There's also deer grass for the coil foundations that some people use.
You know, Richard's going to give us a sign we got to go to quick break, but when we come back, I want to know how this interest of yours got started. How you put this together, because you know basically your book Ethnobiography, I don't think there was nothing like that previous to your study of ethnobotany, and I'm wondering how this caught you, where you caught this in your life, and how this became, you know, 45-50 years of study. How this all started, Dr. Timbrook. Richard, let's go to a quick break, and we get the answer to that question, hopefully, when we get back. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I have the honor of speaking with Dr. Jan Timbrook, who has been, 45, 50 years a scholar of Chumash basketry, ethnobiology, botany, I should say. And I want to know how this interest, Dr. Timbrook, how did it get started? Did you have a mentor? How did you discover this? This was your life's work.
Well, as an undergraduate at UCSB, I majored in anthropology and art. This was in the 60s, and we were all doing kind of artsy, crafty things then. But the single most influential person in my academic career was Dr. Bob Haller, who was a botanist and taught me all about plants of California. It was a life-changing experience, and he influenced so many people who went on to become botanists. And so I was familiar with the plants already. And then when a trove of field notes from the early anthropologist John Harrington turned up, there was a lot of ethnobotany in there. So I had worked at the museum for a while. I could read Spanish. I could read Harrington's handwriting. I knew the plants. So I thought, this is what I was meant to work on, ethnobotany, to pull out the information about how people not only used plants, but how they thought about them and how plants affected their lives and vice versa. So that was really my impetus for ethnobotany. And in terms of how I got interested in basketry, it's partly the sort of crafty stuff that we were doing in the 60s, but also when I started work at the museum, I was working on the Navajo textile collection, cataloging and organizing and curating that, and then moved on to California Indian basketry. And I took lessons, took classes from various people who knew how to identify baskets from various tribes, what the characteristics were. And, I guess the rest is history. I mean, I've been really a basket case ever since then.
So what's the oldest basket in the exhibit?
It's hard to say. We do have some archaeological examples in the exhibit. We have some large storage baskets. We have some of the water bottle baskets. There's a couple of seed beater baskets used to harvest the seeds of like chia sage and so on. We don't really know how old they were. I mean, those were mostly found in caves, dry caves, so they're pretty well preserved. And, you know, it's very likely that they're at least a few hundred years old, probably not much older than that. But we don't, in order to get enough carbon to do radiocarbon dating, you would have to destroy part of the basket. Nobody wants to do that. Now, right. In terms of the oldest thing we know, there's some fragments of seagrass weaving that were found at Daisy Cave on San Miguel Island. Those are about 9,000 years old. So the weaving technology has been around for a really long time.
Was there any sort of, like, I'm thinking of, you know, using, for example, when you're weaving a textile, there's a loom. Is there such thing as a loom or such thing as some kind of, I don't know, program, I want to say? Or as you mentioned in some of the press releases, it's all in the head. Is there some sort of a loom pattern? Is there some, do you know what I'm saying? Is there some sort of support?
Not for Chumash basketry. In the Pacific Northwest and in the Arctic, they did have like a form that they would weave over. That's a completely different technique that they were using up there and really thin, slender material, more like thread almost. But for the Chumash, no, it's like you have the foundation that's spiraling outward from the center, and you take a sewing strand, poke a hole with the bone awl, wrap the sewing strand around, pull it tight. So it's like you're sewing, really. One stitch after another, it's spiraling outward and closing the foundation, sewing into the previous row as you go. So there's no real support structure involved in that at all. It's not at all like a loom.
I see. So am I understanding that this is the largest collection, that our museum has the largest collection of Chumash baskets ever?
Yes, our Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History has the world's largest collection of Chumash baskets. When I started on the staff in 1974, there were three. We had three Chumash baskets, not counting archaeological examples. And in the, 45 years I was on staff, 50 years now, we've gradually increased that number so that now we have 50 or 51 Chumash baskets, including one or two contemporary pieces. But so that's the largest collection in the world. We have more than the Smithsonian. So.
Oh my, I had no idea. That's amazing. How did you amass that collection? I mean, there's got to be private donors, but tell me more about how you built, how many baskets now? You went from three to what number?
So that's a really good question. Actually, very few Chumash baskets have been donated to the museum. There have been some collectors, but you know, these are really beautiful baskets and they are art objects. I mean, you know this from the work that you do. Native American art is bought and sold all the time through auction sites, for collectors and dealers, even on eBay. And so most of the baskets that we have been able to add to the collection have been purchased through auctions or from dealers, in a few instances from private parties. And that's using funds that have been raised from the public, because we have a very limited acquisitions budget. So anytime something would come up that we really wanted to add to the collection, we would have to ask people for money. And, you know, that's one of the things I really, really hate doing is asking people for money. But if it's something you really believe in, it's not so hard. And people have been extremely supportive, people throughout the community. So thanks to everyone for that.
So I'm understanding that you kind of monitored the market.
Oh, I have spies out there who send me links to eBay and to various auction houses saying, have you seen this one that just came up? So, I don't do it so much myself, but I do have people out there who alert me to particularly interesting things that come up.
You know, they can be quite expensive as well.
Oh, yeah. I don't really want to talk about prices, though.
No, we won't go there. Exactly. You know, this is the only previous major exhibit of the Chumash basketry was held previously in 1964 at UCSB. Did you have anything to do with that?
No, that was the year before I came to UCSB.
Oh!
And so I didn't know anything about it. I didn't find out about that until much later. But the people who curated that were professors James Dietz from UCSB and Lawrence Dawson from UC Berkeley. And Dawson was actually one of my mentors in terms of learning how to identify Chumash baskets. So that was really the first and only major Chumash basketry exhibition until now.
That's amazing. Richard's giving us a sign we have to go to another quick break. Hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. And reintroducing, this is Dr. Jan Timbrook, and she's been with the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History for 45 or 50 years, Jan?
Well, actually, from the time I first started as a volunteer, it's now 52 years. But I was on the staff. I was hired in 74.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What a treasure. What a treasure. And we're talking about the living art of Chumash basketry at the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, how Dr. Timbrook became involved in basketry. She is curator emeritus of ethnography at the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, and I have great honor of speaking with her. She's also she's a member of the California Indian Basket Weavers Association, and through that association, she has worked with present-day living contemporary Chumash weavers. I want to talk a little bit about Samantha Sandoval and Suzanne Hamill-Sawyer when we get back from the break, Dr. Timbrook. If you would tell us a little bit about how they are passing on the traditions. You mentioned a little bit about Samantha Sandoval and her closed classes. I want to hear more about them and how the tradition is being passed on. You know, the poster in back of you, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the title of the conference is Tradition and Change. And I want to hear about what that means in regards to Chumash basketry when we get back from the break. Richard, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Jan Timbrook, and it's the living art of Chumash basketry at the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, an exhibit that features the world's largest collection of Chumash baskets. And we talked a little bit about contemporary Chumash weavers, for example, Samantha Sandoval and Suzanne Hamill-Sawyer. Their baskets are also, I believe, both are represented in the exhibit, correct?
Yes, and others as well.
So tell me, how did they learn?
Well, so there's a lot to say about this. The last of the old-time Chumash basket weavers were in Ventura, and they were all gone by 1917. Candelaria Valenzuela, Donaciano Salazar, and Petra Pico, they were the last traditional Chumash basket weavers. And once they were gone, nobody was making Chumash baskets. But in late 70s, early 80s, a local woman, Patricia Anna Campbell, was looking at the baskets on the museum collection that were on exhibit and said, "Those are amazing. We have to figure out how those were made." And so she got an artist in residence grant from the California Arts Council, spent a year at the museum studying baskets in the museum collection, going through literature, looking at various field notes and things, and did a lot of hands-on experimentation. She was one of the really crafty people from UCSB in the 60s. And so she figured out how they were made and began teaching people, the goal of which was to reintroduce that knowledge to Chumash people. And she began teaching on the San Ynez Reservation and elsewhere. And I learned from her, actually. So now, fast forward, there are a bunch of Chumash basket weavers. There are several on the San Ynez Reservation. There's some here in Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo. You know, I don't think there's any active weavers in Ventura, unfortunately. But contemporary weavers that I've worked with are Samantha Sandoval, Suzanne Hamelsoy. Well, first of all, Samantha is a descendant of Maria Ignacio, for whom Maria Ignacio Creek was named. Samantha is her great-great-great-great-granddaughter. And she has collected the basket weaving materials, Juncus Textilis, along Maria Ignacio Creek. So that's kind of a really wonderful full circle kind of a thing. So, and then Suzanne Hamill Sawyer is from San Ynez Reservation, and she lives here in Santa Barbara. She makes amazing baskets. It seems like she's just cranking them out. She has made many, many beautiful baskets. And we have two of them on display at the museum. Then there's Carmen Sandoval, no relation, also a San Ynez weaver. And she's one of the few people who do twine weaving now. So we have one of her baskets on display. And then from the San Luis Obispo area, there's Leah Mata Fragua, who the Northern Chumash weave with different materials. And they have sort of nuanced differences in their weaving. But she's living in New Mexico now and can't get the materials that she needs, but she has been able to acquire some, and so she will have a basket in the exhibit. She's not quite finished with it yet. But so those are some of the contemporary Chumash weavers that I've worked with. But I think because of Samantha's teaching and efforts by other teachers now too, there are more Chumash basket weavers now than there have been in a very long time. And it's wonderful to see that art living again. That's what weavers always tell me, is it is such an honor to carry on these traditions, to walk in the steps of our ancestors, to carry on that knowledge. So I am so honored to have been a small part of that.
So you mentioned that there was the very first woman who was at, tell me her name again, was she at UCSB? And
well, I learned a different kind of weaving from her in the 60s, Patricia Anna Campbell.
Okay.
And she's local. She's a non-Indian, but she does have close ties with various Native American communities. And she is the one who basically, you know, I think single-handedly responsible for bringing this back to life. She doesn't want to take credit for it, but I think it's true.
And so now, okay, tell me what she did exactly.
Well, she got a grant from the California Arts Council, studied baskets in museum collections, found whatever literature she could find about it, including the paper by James Dietz and Larry Dawson about Chumash basketry that was written in 1965, and did a lot of hands-on experimentation. She knew the basics of basket weaving in general, but figuring out specifically what made Chumash baskets distinctive, that was a really important contribution.
Is she still alive?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have an informal weaving group that meets at the museum once a month. It's not a class. We just sit around and weave and gossip. But she often comes to that. And it's, you know, she's a dear friend. It's really wonderful to have her still with us.
Now, this is kind of a stupid question, but I've never been able to pronounce the name of the Garden of Chumash Plants.
Oh, yeah. Chumash languages are a little bit challenging. Richard and I were talking earlier about the Chumash dictionary that was produced by the people at San Ynez Reservation. And, Chumash languages contain sounds that don't occur in English, and so it's kind of a challenge to figure out how to write them down. But the garden is called Suki Nani Koi, and there's a little catch in your throat after the K, Suki Nani Koi, and it means bringing back to life. And when I was first developing the garden, we were trying to choose the name, and I was going through some of the early field notes and came up with that name. And I had a meeting of Chumash people, and they said that should be the name for the garden, because what it means is bringing back to life. And that's what the museum is helping us do with our culture, they said. So that was
I did not know that. I have to tell you an interesting story, Dr. Timbrook. So, I'm an appraiser, and I was hired to do some fire damage work in Plumas County, and a roundhouse, a Native American roundhouse, was burnt down, and it had a collection of I don't know if people that are younger will remember this, but cassette tapes. And the cassette tapes were stories of the elders that were recorded in the 70s and the 80s. And they were speaking in their native language, and they were talking about the art and craft of their tradition. All these were lost in the fire. And it was interesting, because for me to assess the relative value of these things, I had to interview a lot of people that would have purchased or had purchased such collections, such as the Bancroft, et cetera. The attitude of the attorneys involved, they didn't really understand how important these things were. There was, as Richard was saying, about the dictionary, the Chumash dictionary, a dictionary had been thought of, but was not completed. They were about to use these tapes and try to figure out. But it was so sad, because I felt kind of hamstrung. The people that hired me were like, well, these are just cassette tapes. No. They were something very special, and should be really respected and valued. Was there a period in our cultural history where these baskets were not thought of as much as they are now?
Well, I think they're highly prized as art objects now. But in the early 20th century, there was kind of the arts and crafts movement in architecture and decoration and everything. And I think a lot of people collected baskets at that time because they're handmade. It's like the really direct connection between the person who made it and the person who's handling it. So I think baskets have been valued to one degree or another since then. But even early on, the first Spanish explorers that came through our area in 1769 or so, they wrote admiringly of Chumash basketry, and they would actually buy up all the baskets in a village and take them home to family and friends as souvenirs. And so a lot of the finest, earliest baskets wound up in museum collections in Europe or on the East Coast from Yankee whalers who stopped by California on the way to the Hawaiian whaling ground. So I think, some people have always kind of disparaged baskets as nothing special, like craft as opposed to art. But I really do think that Chumash baskets have pretty much always been really appreciated.
That's amazing to me. So, all right. So early explorers would buy up the Chumash basket tree, and they ended up, tell me about the Yankee whalers. So some of the museums on the East Coast have Chumash baskets because of this?
Yes, and they're in private collections too, from some of those old families in New England. So we've got a couple of baskets that came to us through that sort of situation. One was, actually two were collected by a Captain Bradshaw of the whaling ship Lagoda, And I've always thought I should go back to the Whaling Museum in Connecticut and see if I can trace more information about that. But those two are documented as having been collected by one of these Yankee whalers. And then another one was collected by the navigator on a whaling ship, Equator. And we don't know that collector's name, but we know the name of the ship. So, and those are date from about, 1812, 1815 or so. So, these baskets have always been admired. There was another early visitor to Santa Barbara who collected a bunch of baskets. Malaspina was his name. I don't think he actually came to Santa Barbara, but a lot of baskets were sent up to Mission Carmel, where he visited. And so he took those baskets back to Spain, and they're in the Museo de Americas in Madrid right now. And they're really spectacular baskets. The British Museum, George Vancouver stopped in Santa Barbara and collected a whole bunch of baskets in 1792. So Chumash baskets have been admired all around the world.
Well, I had no idea that they had that network of transport that way. That's quite amazing. So tell me a little bit about the early 20th century. We talked a little bit about the 18th century, 19th century, and the whalers, et cetera. The early 20th century, how did people collect these baskets, or were they collected?
By that time, Chumash people weren't necessarily making baskets for their own use. I mean, this is after mission times, and at that point, they had other kinds of containers and tools so they didn't really need baskets for their own use, but they continued making baskets, partly just, to continue the cultural tradition, but also as a source of income. After, especially post-mission, there are very few other sources of income that Native families had. So women were taking in laundry and doing cooking on ranchos and stuff for pay, but also making baskets that they could sell. And so a lot of the, not only Chumash, but other Native American baskets were actually probably made for sale rather than for local indigenous use.
So that was that. I'm glad you led me into this question. What I was kind of driving at is, were the artistic influences affected by the market? So their market is now, not their own culture, but another culture. I'm thinking of rugs, for example, where they're starting to adopt other patterns to make things more marketable for sale. Did that happen with the baskets as well?
Oh yeah, that's very interesting. Some of the, actually in Spanish colonial era, we have examples of Chumash baskets that are made like boxes. They're rectangular boxes with lids. So they didn't originally make baskets with lids. They didn't originally make things in rectangular shape, but Spanish ladies liked rectangular sewing boxes. And so Chumash people made those. They made oval trays. They made baskets with pedestal bases. So they're still using their own traditional weaving techniques, designs, and materials, but weaving in these new shapes to meet the market demand. So they're really creative, really resilient people making these incredible baskets, even despite the changing demand.
I know you don't want to talk about the price or value, but the baskets you're describing that have the influence of the market, are they considered as valuable as let's say, mission era?
Oh, it really depends. Prices in the Native American art market have fluctuated tremendously in the time that I've been looking at this. So it's sort of, dealers have told me that the prices are kind of depressed at the moment, that nobody's collecting fine art, really. Nobody's collecting Native American art now. The old dealers are retiring. Young people want new, modern, high-tech kinds of things. So, but I think that, the pendulum will swing back again, probably.
Absolutely, because it's supply and demand. I mean, there's just one of those things where if I have a collector and they're thinking of selling, it's like, well, this will never happen again. This will not happen again. I mean, that period, that era, this art form, it is going forward thanks to some of the women that you're talking about, Dr. Timbrook. But yeah, Richard's giving us a sign we have to say goodbye. This is so interesting. The exhibit is up now. And I urge you, I stopped in the other day and it's beautiful. It's beautifully laid out. It has photographs. It has the gallery cards are beautifully explanatory. And, you know, you've got to go to the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History and take a look at Chumash Basketry, Art and Life. Incredible. And thank you, Dr. Tim Brook, for all the work you've done and this beautiful exhibit as well. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Bye.